Hi, everyone. I'm going to get started quickly because I want to make sure you're not late to the after reception. I'm going to talk a little bit about continuous delivery on multi-architecture Kubernetes clusters and how Argo CD can help with that. So first, I'm Dave Neary. We're going to start with a very brief introduction of Ampere. So why would you use ARM64 on the cloud, and why would you choose Ampere? We're going to talk about an overview of what continuous delivery and GitOps are. I'll admit I'm a little nervous with this audience because I think some of this material might be a little remedial. But I learned a lot putting this talk together, and I'm hopeful that you will learn a lot as well. But maybe you all know all of this stuff already. And then we're going to talk about how you can bring it all together and actually use Argo CD to help with your platform migration. Okay, so introduction to Ampere. Why would you consider ARM64 for your cloud applications, and why should you consider Ampere? Well, the first is Ampere, we make CPUs, and they're designed from the ground up for the cloud. What we mean when we talk about Ampere CPUs being cloud-native CPUs is they're single-threaded cores, so they scale linearly under load, which allows you to use the hardware you're paying for. We provide a lot of cores per socket, which is very good for the cloud service provider because they have more cores per rack, which means it's good for you because they have they can rent you those cores cheaper. So it's built for the cloud from the scratch, from the ground up. It's really good for your pocket because the instances tend to be cheaper. You can typically run typical cloud workloads for 20-30% cheaper on ARM64 instances compared to x86. And I know it's a little bit kitsch, but it's good for the planet, right? This is one of the ways that we scale computing in the cloud. In the AI world, is we get more workloads running on CPUs instead of GPUs, and we get more cores in a rack, more cores in a data center. That allows us to grow sustainably and not have this trade-off between, you know, are we going to build more houses or more data centers, which is kind of the situation we're in right now. Okay, that's the commercial breakover. The cloud has changed the way applications are designed and implemented. We've gone from monolithic three-tier applications to microservice applications, where we've got dozens of services or applications are now in a part of an application, of dozens of individual components are working together to deliver an application. Each of those components scales independently, right? So you can have an application like Uber has, you know, thousands of compute elements, you know, between VMs, containers, even functions, that are all running together and have to be managed collectively, right? So this is just an example. Each microservice is developed, updated, and scaled independently. Architecture becomes more sophisticated. You have to worry about interfaces between different components. But the individual components themselves become simpler, right? You have kind of storage, a little bit of compute, right? A little bit of logic, business logic, and then an API interface, typically. Right, so zooming in on a single service, relationships between services are defined by well-defined APIs. Each service is going to have its own multiple components, its own scaling, its own application logic, its own data. Packaging, testing, maintaining consistency becomes a challenge. Right, so that's how the cloud changed application development. Continuous deployment came along and is one way to address that. You package up your application in one environment, you package up your execution environment, where you have a test execution, pre-prod, prod, production. You package up your environment definitions in another repository, and then you can build your application, test your application. You can package your application and then you deploy it on an environment and then you test with your environment and then you can deploy that to production, promote that to production. This is how continuous deployment has worked. But if you add ARM64 on top of x86, AMD 64 to the mix, you have some work to do, right? If you're doing continuous deployment, your provisioning a build environment is going to be different because you're using an ARM64 environment rather than an x86 environment. You need to make sure that all of your development tools are building ARM64 native binaries. And then you need to have an ARM64 test environment. If you're going to be running across multi-architecture, you can't just rely on your AMD64 tests catching all of the issues. You may have some x86 isms in your code. You may have some dependency that isn't packaged or built on ARM64. So you need to make sure that you're running all of your tests on an ARM64 environment as well. Then you need to make sure that all of your tests are built to run on ARM64, right? So there's a little bit of development work there. And then finally, we get to provisioning and deploying. And there's going to be some differences in your CI in terms of how you build and package software, and there's going to be some differences in your CD in terms of how you provision environments and make sure that your code is running on them. Okay, so the GitOps fundamental, and again, I apologize, this is kind of elementary, but the fundamental idea of GitOps is that you have an environment. You've got your application is in a Git repository. When you commit changes to it, it kicks off CI build. You build a new package. That build and test cycle means that you've generated typically at the end a container, which is basically a file system that's packaged up into a single binary file. You push that to a container repository, and then you have you change the application manifest in a different Git repository to say, oh, hey, I'm pulling the new image. And when you push that new manifest into a Git repository, you have your GitOps operator is monitoring that repository and kicks off a deploy if it's configured to do it. Okay. So that's very much like the high-level overview. But how do you actually do it? How do you bring it all together? How does ARM64, adding ARM64 to your infrastructure change what you do? So it's kind of a layer cake, right? Every single layer, there's something that you need to learn if you're going to do ARM64 application deployment. So at the bottom level, it's kind of containers. You need to make sure you're building multi-arch containers. Then you need to make sure that you're pushing and tagging your images correctly in your container repository. Your Kubernetes YAML for deployment is going to change so that you can match workloads to the nodes you want to run them on. And then finally, you need to make sure that you're encapsulating all of that in your Helm operator, your application definition manifest, and then finally in your GitOps operator, you need to make sure that you're not doing anything wrong. But there are only a couple of areas that care about the architecture, right? Primarily, you need to make sure that you're building your containers for ARM64, and you need to make sure that you've got application affinity right at the Kubernetes YAML level. Everything else kind of takes care of itself. Okay, so what does building a multi-architecture container involve? Binaries need to be compiled for every architecture you're going to support. There are multiple ways of doing that. You can use something like Docker BuildX or Podman. I think Podman Build just has --- architecture. Somebody from Red Hat here will probably correct me if I'm wrong. But you can either do a single build step that does an emulated x86 build, uses the tooling in that way, or you can independently build your AMD64 and your ARM64 containers, push them both, create a manifest from those images, and then push the manifest. There are a few gotchas. Here's with Podman. Method one is you build the separate images, so you do a Podman build, you push your images, you create a manifest from that, add the images to it, and then you push the manifest. Or you can do it in one step, but then you're not necessarily building each container on native hardware. And if your builds are long, you may want to make sure you're building on the hardware that matches the architecture you're running. So yeah, six steps or three. That's basically it. Your image manifests. This is a gotcha that I've seen where somebody does a Docker pulls with a SHA-ID, and the image that gets pulled is different from that, and that confuses the person. What happens is when you pull a manifest file, it says, oh, you're on Linux ARM64 or Linux AMD64, and it pulls the right image. So this one refers to this SHA image,
And then this one is referring to a different shell ID for ARM64. And it basically pulls the right one for you and says, oh yeah, we pulled the right image. There are a few gotchas here. The first one, for those of you like me who are getting a little bit older and whose sight is not maybe the best, AMD64 and ARM64 look really close. So I don't know if anybody else has been caught up with that, but I've definitely spent, yes. also, another issue, it's really, really easy, because there's no safeguard, it's really easy to push the AMD64 or ARM64 Docker image that's built for that architecture to the manifest tag, right? So you overwrite the manifest, but it's actually an x86 binary. So if you try and pull that onto ARM, it's just not going to work. And it's kind of fails kind of silently, which sucks. So you need to be really careful of how you tag images and make sure that you've got good workflow practices for your building and container pushing. Okay, so up to layer 3. Layer 0 was containers, layer 1 was the tagging, Quay or Docker Hub. So typical Kubernetes application, and again, this may be super elementary, but like you have a deployment or a pod or a replica set, but we'll get into the difference between all of those in a moment, that's exposed by a service. There are other objects, config max secrets, but you know, it's not unusual to have that basic, like from the compute perspective, it's a deployment as exposed by a service. This is a pop quiz. Okay, this is going to be hard to read, but I'm asking for a shout out. What's running after I do this? I create a replica set, give it a name. I have a spec selector match label that's going to match the label on my container spec down here. Yes. So I've got a template for my containers in the replica set. The label here matches the match labels, and I create two replicas of image nginx 1.26. This is easy. This is not intended to be hard. After I apply this manifest, what do I have? A replica set running two nginx pods, nginx 1.26. It is not hard, right? So you end up with two nginx pods. They each get their test RS, so they get the name and then some extra stuff. Okay, step 2 is where it gets interesting. After doing this, I update my replica set definition to use a different image, like a nginx latest instead of nginx 1.26. They are different versions, with 4 replicas. Same label, same selector match. What do I have running after I run this?
New replica set.
I have a new replica set with how many images?
4
images of what?
Pods with different images.
4 images of nginx latest. Anybody think he's wrong?
If they still have the same shard, will still be 1.26.
No, it's a different shard. The image is different.
Okay.
No, you do not. You have 2 images running nginx 1.26 and 2 images running latest. Replica sets are not declarative. The only thing that a replica set does is it monitors how many images with the given match label are running. So it doesn't kill the old ones. Now, step 3.
Wait, but it just spawns the new ones?
It detects that there are not four pods with that label running. And so it starts 2 more with the image template that's in there. Okay, pop quiz number 3. I've got my list of containers. I'm going to delete one of the pods, nginx 1.26, with the manifest I had before. What happens now?
It uses the same replica set.
Yeah, it's the same replica set. So it starts a 4th image. No. 1.26? Well, actually, no, because what it does is that if it goes below the number, it uses the template to start new images. So, yeah, it kills one of the 1.26s and it starts an nginx. The whole point is replica sets are not declarative. I mean, you will find on the internet that they are, but no. The right way to do this, I think they're kind of magic, is to use deployments. So replica sets just ensure that a certain number of containers with a given label are running, or whatever selector rule you've given. Replica sets use the template in the replica set definition only when they're creating new containers. But deployments do not manage pods, they manage replica sets. So here's how a deployment works. And we'll get to how it works. Here's how a deployment works. When I apply a deployment, and it's different from what's running, what it will do is it creates a new replica set. And it's got two parameters. Max surge is how many images more than the number of replicas you've asked for can be running. That can be a percentage, it can be a raw number. And max unavailable, which is how many images less than the number of replicas you've requested must be running at all times. There's a number of reasons why you can go below the number of replicas that you're asking for. So what it'll do is it'll create a new replica set. It tries to start the first pod in the new replica set and tries to stop the last pod in the old replica set. And basically, it adjusts the number of pods running so that you always have more or less around the number of replicas that you want at the end. But you'll see this nice little dance where replica set one is like, we have three pods, we want to have two, we're waiting for the third, but we're waiting for the third one to shut down. And the same way, like, it'll start pods, it may take a few seconds for a pod to start in the new replica set, and until that container has started, it won't shut anything down in the old one. So that's how deployments work. That's how rolling update by default works. So let's talk about workload placement. The most important thing about this is, like, if you're talking about multi-architecture, you want to make sure that you're putting the pods that you want on the right architecture. The most basic way to do workload placement is with a node selector. You basically have, you can mark nodes with a tab. So you label a node with the tab disk type equals SSD. Oh, shit. I should not have done that. We'll get back to it in a second. So you label a node with a specific identifier, and then you have a node selector section in your pod definition that says I want to run on nodes with this constraint, and that works well. How am I doing on time, by the way? 17:15. Okay, node selector, disk type SSD. So this is like, I want to run on a node with SSD. There are also a set of metadata that comes along with the node, you know, like Kubernetes, we'll see the architecture one in a little while. Node selector forces workload placement on nodes with that label. This is not ideal. Because sometimes what you want to do is you want to enforce a constraint, but you want it to be, for example, a constraint that applies on execution, but not on, a constraint that applies on workload placement, but not on execution. Or sometimes you want to move a workload off a node if a certain condition is met later. So these are kind of restrictive because they only apply when the pod is being scheduled, as far as I know. The other way that workload placement works is taints and toleration. So you basically taint a node with a certain scheduling restriction. You can say, for example, the taint here at the top is nodes. So we're tainting node one. If key one is equal to value one, we can schedule. Otherwise, we don't schedule any workloads there. And there are a number of taints that are set automatically as the cluster is operating. If you have, for example, memory pressure, disk pressure, you can have situations where workloads are evicted from a node or not scheduled on that node. And pods then have tolerations indicating that they require or prefer, and these can be both required or preferred, certain capabilities. So some of the taints used can be used to prevent scheduling on busy nodes or to evict nodes, for example, if you put a node into maintenance mode, right? So memory pressure, disk pressure, PID pressure are the three that are very commonly found in the wild. I guess that's a copy. But there's a third method, and this is the one that I would recommend, is to use affinity. Node affinities are similar to node selector, but with some important differences. You can have required characteristics or preferred characteristics. So, for example, if there's an SSD node available, I want to deploy this workload on an SSD node. Otherwise, I'll take whatever you have, right? What matters more to me is that I run. You can also apply affinities to scheduling, but also to execution. So if the conditions change and the conditions when I scheduled a workload change, I may choose to, for example, evict a pod from a node if the memory usage goes above a certain threshold because that node is particularly memory sensitive, right? And here we see the most important affinity for placing ARM64 workloads. There is a default metadata key, kubernetes.io/arch. And you can, this is saying, anytime we're going to schedule an image, it's ignored during execution because it only matters scheduling. We're going to see if the architecture is in either ARM64 or AMD64. I just put that in there. Like, it doesn't, if your cluster only has ARM64 and AMD, this is basically a no-op. But you can say, by putting in just ARM64, you can say, this pod I want to run on ARM64. Or you can use some kind of routing to say, I want to run on ARM64 if we have ARM64 nodes available that fulfill the other conditions, like memory and storage availability. But I'll fall back to AMD64. Okay, so layer 4 Helm charts, and I'm not going to go into this at all, except to say Helm charts are basically a way to have like Go code in your Kubernetes YAML. That's a drastic oversimplification, but it's a way to template configuration to have a little bit more simpler constructs in terms of how you parameterize your application in something like in the values.yaml in particular, something like the Bitnami Helm charts all use a common base library that provides some convenience functions for things like workload placement. But it's basically, I used something called Helmify, if any of you have come across it. So creating a Helm chart is kind of a pain in the ass to me. But you can use Helmify and it will create a Helm chart for you and give you a values.yaml that makes sense. So that's how I did it. Okay, and finally, Argo CD. So this is obviously invisible, but basically with Argo CD, what you're doing is you're associating a Git repository with a cluster, right? So you have a Argo CD itself is an operator, it runs on a Kubernetes cluster, but you can associate a different cluster with the application that's running on Argo CD, and then you associate it with a Git repository, which is defining the Helm charts or the application manifests that are going to be running on that cluster. So step one, you identify your Kubernetes cluster using kubectl config get contexts. It will give a list of clusters. You choose the cluster that you want to deploy this application to. And then you can create an application which is pointing to a specific git.git repository. So, the URL from GitHub or whatever. And you associate that with the namespace you're going to deploy your application in. And then you already have your Argo CD cluster add connects that to the cluster. So you identify your cluster ID, you add your cluster to Argo CD, and then you create your application to connect to the Git repository. And that gives you this, basically. So you can see on the Argo CD dashboard, the application is running okay. When did it last sync? What's the sync status? So is the Git repository that I've committed my manifest into, is it ahead of where I am or not? And there are a number of things that you can do for syncing, right? The basic is you sync in a new version, you can do it automatically. I'll share these slides, but this is unreadable. There are multiple sync options on how you can change the previous version once you sync a new version. Do you sync automatically or do you sync manually? The default is manual, but it's tweakable. Okay, so here's really where I think Argo can help with cross-platform deployment. Because I don't know about y'all, but I'm kind of nervous every time I change a YAML file and I apply it, will I break something? Argo rollouts kind of help you prevent that by helping with the migration, providing rollback opportunities, making sure that you can do things like deployment strategies like blue-green, canary, progressive delivery out of the box. It makes it really easy to do these things. So it provides a set of custom CRDs to define applications, to define rollouts. Here's basically how a blue-green deployment works if you're not using Argo rollouts, right? So you have some kind of an ingress controller that you configure. You can use Nginx, you can use Istio. You configure it to go to a blue service. That blue service is associated with a blue deployment. And that's the state before you start. So the steps that you have to follow, you create your green deployment, create your new service. So it's a kubectl apply minus F green deployment. Then you have to update your ingress so that it's routing traffic to the green service instead of the blue service. And then you can, for example, scale your blue service to zero. But it's all manual. That's the point, right? If you do the same thing in Argo CD rollouts, you basically create a rollout. So it's a different kind. And in the template for how we update the rollout, you've got a strategy section that's new. Before your spec says, I'm going to create blue images. And you say, my strategy for rollouts is blue-green. I'm going to enable auto-promotion. I'm going to make the active service as demo service. So that's, I'm using the ingress goes to a service and I'm confusing myself. So strategy blue-green. That's the important part. The after is I update my image demo blue to image demo green. I set the image for rollout to green, and then I'm done. Right? Argo CD takes care of the progressive delivery. It takes care of starting up the green and scaling down the blue. And I don't have to do anything at all. To do it for, this is an example, canary. And then if you want to do a canary deployment where you want to have some kind of health test associated with the new version to make sure everything is working before you go any further, you just use a strategy canary. So it's like it comes inbuilt with some deployment strategies that are really, really useful out of the box. And if what you want to do is migrate, say, an application component that you've compiled in a multi-architecture container from AMD64 to ARM64, the only thing you need to do is add the node affinity section and say, okay, this used to be AMD64, and I'm going to switch it to ARM64. I commit, I push this new manifest, and Argo CD is going to pick it up, and then I can sync, and it will move the workloads across to ARM64, only if it works, right? So we'll have a health check as well. So that's the magic, right? So if you can get to the point of, I have multi-architecture containers, I understand the kubectl affinity rules and how I can apply them. Creating a Kubernetes cluster with ARM and x86 nodes, how to do that is differs by CSP. It's possible on all of the major CSPs, or it's possible with all of the major Kubernetes distributions, but the tooling to do it is vendor by vendor. It hasn't been standardized by the CNCF yet, which is a bit of a pain. But once you've done that, once you have the x86 and the ARM64 nodes in there, making the change is as simple as make sure your containers are multi-arch, and then add the node affinity field to your pod template in your rollout. And you're done. Which I think is kind of magic. And I think that is all I have for you. We do have some developer resources, the Ampere Developer Center. This is probably not photoable or scannable, but I recommend if any of you want information about using Ampere processors or using using ARM64 instances on any of the major clouds. So the Ampere Developer Center is a great resource. We've got lots of content in there, lots of benchmarking material, tutorials on how to get started. We've got a newsletter that you can sign up for that's monthly. And the Ampere Developer Community is a really active forum of people who are interested in this field and who want to discuss anything they come across, whether it's solving hardware issues at the low end to getting my application working on Kubernetes at the high end, or what are the best options for AI inference on ARM64. So I recommend that you come along. Thank you all for your time today, and I am able to take questions. I think I even got through that a little ahead of time. Ooh. I got us back on track. Ooh, beer. Thank you. Okay, anybody have any questions before we knock off? Back of the room.
So if I were to deploy a service where I don't care if it runs on AMD 64 or ARM 64,
yep.
Would I just, let's say, add a page so I make sure it doesn't mix up my other applications, register the ARM node, and then just add a toleration, and then the manifest point to the correct image, AMD or ARM?
I believe that if you have a node affinity and you put both architectures in there, the first one gets the first deployment, the second one gets the second one, and so on. I believe, but I may be wrong. It may be random. But yes, that would certainly, you could deploy to either. Once you have two architectures in your cluster, if you're not mentioning which one you're deploying to, you're going to deploy to either.
I can answer that. We have Grafana with two architectures, and we just don't have to deploy the set the tolerations,
yep.
And then the scheduler picks the test node, whatever it chooses. So
the answer is Grafana runs on both architectures, and the scheduler picks whatever node is
easiest. That you have the different CVE per architecture, and we had a problem where, for example, AMD images were with CVE, but for ARM they were not. They were clean. So we had to add toleration and paints, and then switch from AMD to ARM.
And that's, by the way, a really good, like, sometimes you will have issues with AMD 64 images that you don't have with ARM 64, or vice versa. And adding a taint or adding a toleration to the pods to say, okay, because of this issue, if the version is X, then I require no schedule on this type of node. That's a way to get around that, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's one more thing that you don't have to create a new manifest. You can, for example, define a tool to clean the images or rules to remove the containers with given architecture. There's a Kubernetes tool named the scheduler that you can create a policy that, okay, find all the images from AMD and destroy them, leave only ARM.
Oh, okay. I was not aware of that. Apparently, there's a tool that can remove all of the AMD 64 images from your manifest?
No, from
your scheduler for you. Mm-hmm. Is that a question? No, you were just scratching your head. Okay. Any other questions?
No, I have that too.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I guess it is beer o'clock. Yeah.